Do any of you ever listen to these audio lectures? Do you? Good. Then it's worth my while to do it. In any case, you're going to miss out the first part of this lecture because it's your responsibility from now on. What is your name?
Anna.
Anna, that's right. I should remember that. Anna, it's going to be your responsibility to remind me to turn on the recorder.
Okay?
Alex asks a really good question. Does this represent the beginning of the Romanization of the church? There's another fact, Alex, that we should consider as part of your question. If we go back to our timeline, it's a point I think I made at the end of class last time, but I'm not absolutely sure that I did. Wait a minute. There is a significant change. Did I talk about this last time? Right at the very top. During the 7th and 5th, the 7th and 6th centuries, as you can see from the timeline, all the popes were Greek. Now, why were all the popes Greek, Mike?
Because that's what they at the time the church was still Greek. Right?
Well, no, not in the West. Not in the West. I'm thinking politically. Why were all the popes Greek? Chris, right?
Yeah. There's more Greek bishops, so they would elect the Greek.
No, the Pope was only elected by the people in Rome, both lay people, believe it or not, and the clergy. There were no cardinals at this time, and so the Pope was elected, but only by the people in Rome. Alex?
It's because Constantinople was in the East.
Well, Constantinople exercised before the period that we're talking about now, Constantinople exercised an enormous amount of influence and authority. And all of these Greek popes, always after their election by the Roman people and by the Roman clergy, always wrote to the emperor in Constantinople to ask for his approval of their election. You can't imagine a pope doing that today, can you? But this was because of the great influence. You wanted to say something. I'm forgetting your name. What's your name?
Chris.
Oh, you're Chris too. That's right. So in any case, if you've been reading while I've been yammering, if you've been looking at the timeline, there was the first Roman Pope was Gregory II, who was elected after 7 consecutive Greek popes. And then there was another Pope named Gregory III, and Zacharias, who were Greek popes. And Zacharias was the last Greek pope in the line. And Chris, why was Zacharias the last Greek pope in the line? Did that mean that the clergy and the people of Rome no longer liked Greeks?
No,
it didn't. Why was Zacharias the last Greek pope? Period. There was never another Greek pope after Zacharias. Alex?
Change in power.
That change in power, the same reason why the Byzantines would not help Pope Stephen, is the same reason. There's a cataclysmic shift of power in the Mediterranean, caused in large part by what, Mike? This cataclysmic shift in power, Liz?
By the fact that the Pope can depend on a Western ruler.
Well, it depends on the Western ruler, but why did the Pope start depending on Western rulers?
Well, because the Byzantine has...
No, you're... Why were the Byzantines weakened? Because of the expansion of Islam, the military and political expansion of Islam. It all fits together so wonderfully if you understand it. There's the Byzantine power diminishes because of Islam. The papacy can no longer depend. It's a two-way street. The papacy can no longer depend on Constantinople But Constantinople can no longer exercise any jurisdiction over the papacy. It's a two-way street, and so the papacy has to turn to the West. And once the papacy, and this gets back to Alex's very good question, once the papacy turns to the West, and there are no more Greek popes, that really is a sign of the Romanization, if you want to call it that, the Romanization of the church. All the popes after Zacharias were Latin. They were Western Mediterranean. They were Western Europeans. Now, oh, what is this? There we go. What I'm showing you and what this link hooks up to is legislation that Charlemagne promulgated in the 770s, 780s, and 790s. And what I'm going to concentrate on is his legislation on forcing. This link is not going to the right place. His legislation in ecclesiastical matters, but also his legislation governing pagans and non-Christians. Ah, here we go, right here. I want to draw your attention particularly to 8, to 9, to 10, and also the bloodthirstiness, I suppose, of this Carolingian legislation. But as you see, from 8 and 9 and 10 in particular, when I talked about conversion by the sword, it just wasn't conversion by the sword on the military field. Charlemagne also promulgated laws which enforced the forced conversion of Saxons and other pagans as well. Number 8, if any one of the race of the Saxons slides back in the paganism, his penalty is death. If anyone sacrifices to the devil, he'd be punished by death. If anyone has a conspiracy against Christians, the penalty is death. In fact, if I'm not going to scroll through all of them, but if you go through all of these texts, you'll notice that the death penalty is alive and well in the Carolingian realm in the 8th and the early 9th century. The main point of these statutes issued by Charlemagne, they're called technically capitularies, that was the Carolingian word for law. These capitularies were designed to punish any backsliding or any pagan who was baptized, and these were forcible baptisms, they were not baptisms free of their own free will. Any pagan, any Saxon, who lapsed back into paganism, the punishment was death. perhaps the most significant, to go back to our timeline, Alex.
Are there any pagan martyrs?
It's actually, it sounds like a silly question at first, but it's kind of a good question. Why wouldn't there be, let's turn it around, why wouldn't there be pagan martyrs? Yes?
Because in order to be a martyr for religion, you need to have a religion.
Oh, you have to have a what?
God.
You have to believe in a God. You have to believe that your loyalty should be to, you have to be monotheistic, I think. Because remember, in the Greco-Roman religions and in pagan religions in general, you have many, many gods. And you don't promise your fealty and loyalty to one God in particular, do you? And so remember at the beginning of the semester we talked about that a bit, that's called polytheism, the belief that there are many gods and that you can sacrifice and to many gods. And so paganism and the pagan Saxons were not Greco-Roman pagans. We're talking about a whole different set, a whole different pantheon of gods. The Germanic gods are very different from the Greco-Roman gods. But you can't have a martyr, or there would be no reason to have a martyr for someone who believed in many gods. You want me to get rid of one God? Okay, I'll get rid of him. There isn't the same devotion that is characteristic of Judaism and Christianity and Islam as well. I mean, after all, you read the newspapers today and you read about martyrs, don't you? But they're not martyrs, they're not Christian martyrs, they're Islamic martyrs. Charlemagne and the papacy. Perhaps this point is the most important. Well, I don't know. Establishment of the papal states is awfully important. But Charlemagne's relationship with the papacy and this particular event that I'm going to talk about now could be argued as the most important event in Charlemagne's reign. And the story is simply this, and if you're reading the screen, I'll just fill in a few of the blanks. Because of what I just said to Chris, and this is a point you should remember for the future, the Pope was not elected in anything like the way that the Pope was elected before. Now. The papacy was, the Pope was elected by the clergy and the people of Rome, and the aristocracy of Rome, the nobles of the city of Rome, played an enormously important role in the election of the papacy. Now, this is going to, in the 10th and 11th centuries, this is going to cause an enormous amount of trouble in Rome, and it's going to cause an enormous amount of trouble for the papacy, but it also caused trouble earlier, and what you're looking at is an example of it, because there were two factions in Rome at this time. One was the faction of the dead pope who had just died, and the other was the faction of the new pope, Leo. And when Leo the third was elected pope, there was an enormous amount of opposition, not among the clergy as far as we can say, although as far as we can see, although the clergy may have been on, some of them may have been unhappy as well, but it was the Roman aristocracy that was enormously or part of the Roman aristocracy that was enormously unhappy with the election of Leo III. And so, as you can see, Leo was constantly attacked. Every time there was a public ceremony, Leo was attacked by Roman mobs. Well, I shouldn't say Roman mobs, I should say the Roman opposition to his pontificate. And the upshot was that he actually went all the way to Northern Europe to seek out Charlemagne. And this is sort of repeating, isn't it? He doesn't turn to Constantinople. He doesn't turn to the Byzantine. That is already far in the past. He turns to Charlemagne for protection. And so he goes to Charlemagne's capital, which is the modern German city of Aachen, which is located in the far north of Germany. The next time I show you a map, I'll show you where his capital city was. Remember, I did show you the chapel of Charlemagne last time. Well, the chapel of Charlemagne is located in Aachen. He goes to Aachen. He seeks Charlemagne's help. And the upshot is that Charlemagne goes down to Rome, takes an army down to Rome to protect Leo III. And what happens then is, again, from our modern standpoint, just bizarre. Because the Pope was put on trial. Now, you may know that it is a tenet of papal power today that the Pope can be judged by no one. But the Pope was put on trial, and he was forced to do a rite of purgation. In other words, he had to stand at the altar in St. Peter's, in the Basilica of St. Peter's, and he had to perform an oath, which was called an oath of purgation, in which he avowed that he was not guilty of the crimes that his opponents were accusing him of. And after this trial, in which Charlemagne declared that Pope Leo was innocent of all the crimes of which he was accused, on Christmas Day of 800, Charlemagne, and there are conflicting stories about this, but supposedly Charlemagne walked into St. Peter's in Rome. He was confronted during the Mass in St. Peter's on Christmas Day, December 25th, 800. He was confronted by a Pope, Leo III, who wanted to crown him Roman Emperor. I'm pausing because I want that to sink in a little bit. The Pope, Leo III, crowned Charlemagne Roman Emperor. There had not been a Roman Emperor in the West since 476. For 324 years, there hadn't been a Roman Emperor in the West. You may have noticed from the map that Charlemagne's empire was not centered in Rome, was it? Now, I want you to ask yourself the question, under what authority did the Bishop of Rome have the jurisdictional right to crown Charlemagne Roman Emperor? How he made an emperor? On what grounds, by what reason, by what law, by what authority does the Pope have the right to do that? Alex?
Wasn't it under the authority that Pepin gave the papal state?
Well, what Pepin did and what Charlemagne confirmed was just that the Pope was a prince in the papal states. He wasn't the emperor. It was just a small state, smaller than many other kingdoms in Europe. You're all brilliant today. Yes, Rachel.
Could it be because, back way before when Pope ascended, he had higher authority than the emperors?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point, Rachel. You're remembering the letter of Pope Gelasius, in which he, for the first time, said that that papal power is superior to secular power, and that letter of Gelasius was well known both in Rome as well as in Northern Europe as well. And so we don't know. We don't know Leo III's rationale for doing this. He never wrote it down. These are the reasons why I think I have the authority to crown Charlemagne and to create for Charlemagne this title of Roman Emperor. We have no idea. But because it was completely unprecedented, there were no precedents. And Rachel is probably giving brilliantly the best possible argument that if we had Leo here in the classroom, that we could get out of him. He could have said, well, my office as Bishop of Rome is superior to any secular authority, as Pope Gelasius said. Pope Gelasius was talking about spiritual authority, but you could make the argument that if the spiritual power is greater than the secular power, then the spiritual power should be or could be able to bestow honors and titles on the secular power. You could make that argument. Well, spiritually they were under the Pope, that's right. Spiritually they were under the Pope. And Charlemagne and his father, one of these stories that I've been telling you, is that Charlemagne and his father greatly respected the office of the papacy and honored the primacy of the Bishop of Rome. There's no question about this. And that was probably one of the reasons why Charlemagne accepted the title. What do you think the reaction, Rachel, of the emperor in Constantinople was?
Very upset.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it wasn't he who was very upset. It was she. There was an empress in Constantinople. There wasn't an emperor. Her name was Empress Irene. And Empress Irene was pissed as hell that the Pope had conferred this title, which belonged to Constantinople now, didn't it? It didn't belong to Rome any longer. It hadn't belonged to Rome for centuries. And the Byzantines were very angry about this bestowal, this usurpation of power by the Pope. I said that this was probably the most important event of Charlemagne's reign, and I said it was the most important event because it has the greatest significance that lasts for centuries afterwards. Another way of thinking about this, and it's going to be important for the future, is the Pope Leo III shot himself in the foot when he created a Roman emperor in the West. He shot himself in the foot. Why do I say that? Isaac.
Because he's Charlemagne has control over Byzantium and Rome.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't say that he has control over Byzantium or Constantinople.
Well, it doesn't actually create tension between the two empires. So,
well, it creates tension. It did create tension between the two empires, which is going to last for centuries, by the way. There's going to be tension between the Western Emperor, the Western Germanic Emperor, and the Emperor in Constantinople for centuries. But
does that tension kind of trickle down to the religious level as well?
Think about what Rachel said about the spiritual. Who could argue up until the coronation of Charlemagne as emperor, who could argue that they were the highest office, the highest power, the most elevated power in the West up until December 25th of 800 A.D.?
He gave him his jurisdiction.
No, I'm answer my question, Alex, first.
The Roman Pope.
The Pope. There was only one universal ruler in Europe. And what did the Pope do?
He gave power to a secular ruler.
He gave power, but think about this. Whether you believe Pope Gelasius that the spiritual power is greater than the temporal power, and people argued about that for centuries as well. What exactly did that mean? But what Pope Leo did is to create another universal ruler in Western Europe. And what we're going to see during the entire rest of this semester is these two universal rulers, one created by Pope Leo III, the other one, the Bishop of Rome, are going to fight and clash over who has jurisdiction in which matters up until the end of the semester. There is going to be a constant clash between these two claimants to universal rulership in Latin Christendom. And that wouldn't have happened if Pope Leo had not created the title of emperor and not bestowed that title, Roman emperor, and not bestowed that title on Charlemagne. Now, I put some facts there just to impress upon you how long what Leo III did last. And as you can see, the title of Holy Roman Emperor in the West, in the Latin West, it disappears. The empire disappears in the East in 1453 with the fall of Constantinople. But the title of emperor lasts in the West until 1806. In other words, 1,000 years after Pope Leo crowned Charlemagne Roman Emperor, that title lived on in the West for until 1806. And furthermore, as part of this conflict that I just described, this conflict continues well into the early modern period as well. It was the Catholic Christian emperor, the Emperor Charles V, who declined to have the Pope crown him. Every emperor up until Charles V recognized that the only way that his title as Roman emperor was legitimate and valid was by his consecration and anointing by the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. And what do you think it means? I'm asking too many questions today, forgive me. What do you think it means when Charles V said, no? Remember, he is the Catholic emperor.
He didn't need the Pope's approval.
That's right. He is rejecting the idea. Charles V had a grandiose view of his role in Christian society. If you've had some early modern history, you know about the grandiose role that he had, or his conception of his authority. And what he is saying is essentially, if you think about it, Mike, Leo III didn't have the authority to do it. Leo III did not, when Charles V rejects the Pope's authority and jurisdiction to create an emperor, what he's essentially did was to reject the whole idea that Leo III could do it. Now there's a contradiction there, isn't there? There's a great contradiction, because that would mean that he's not really the Holy Roman Emperor, because the whole basis of his power and authority is illegitimate. And then there's a really famous painting that I just saw when I was in Paris this summer in the Louvre. But there's this wonderful painting of Napoleon. Napoleon crowned himself emperor. At least Charles V had a ceremony in which his bishops crowned him emperor. But this famous painting by David shows that Napoleon crowned his empress, who was kneeling before him, crowns her empress of his empire. And then, in order to signify in 1803 that he has no connection whatsoever with religious power and the power, remember that Napoleon is a Catholic as well, rejecting the connection between the empire and the papacy, he places the crown on his own head. So, those are the three most significant aspects of the reign of Charlemagne and why he's important for the history of the church. The last is Carolingian culture. Now, you may think that after what I said about the Charlemagne slaughter of 4,500 Saxon boys at Verdun, that perhaps Carolingian culture would be an oxymoron. But Charlemagne, although Charlemagne himself, as far as we know, was illiterate. If he could write, he couldn't write very well or much. And if he could read, ditto. He couldn't read very much either. He had, and this is one of the ironies of talking about Charlemagne, he had a great respect for culture. And in many ways, Charlemagne reintroduces culture and learning into Europe after the so-called Dark Ages. And the way in which he did it was he established in his capital, at his palace in Aachen, he established a school in which he brought scholars from all over Europe. He brought them to Aachen in order to teach in this school. And two of the most famous are Alcuin and Einhard. I have a lot more information about both of them on the web, and I'm not going to say anything more about them now. You can. Logan has a bit of information about both of them in your textbook. But the main thing that I wanted to talk about in light or in connection with Carolingian culture is a great transformation which Charlemagne's scholars were responsible for in the way in which culture was transmitted in the 9th and 10th centuries. And in order to talk about that, I want to first show you what a book looked like in the 4th and 5th centuries. This is a is a Latin translation that predated the Jerome Vulgate and is a manuscript dating from about, somewhere around 500 to 600 AD. Bridget, come here. I want you to get a good look at this manuscript. Can you read any of it?
Yeah.
Yes, you can?
Yeah.
No, you can't. What's really unusual about this script? Actually, the letters are pretty clear. This is a D, that's a U, that's an O, that's a D, that's an E, here's an S, a P, an E, an R. The letters are, I mean, if you knew Latin, if you were a really good Latinist, you might be able to read it. But what's really unusual about this text? Give Bridget a chance. Just a second.
It's written in columns.
Now, it's in columns, but, you know, books are sometimes in columns, particularly encyclopedias, right? Even today. And this tradition was started a long time ago, as you can see. Something very strange.
There are no spaces.
There are no spaces between the words. Can you imagine what that would be like to try and read something if there were no spaces between the words? It would be very, very difficult. All you have to do is write something and then afterwards just temporarily take all the spaces out of what you've written. And even in English and something that you yourself have written, it's going to be very hard to read what you've written. All writing up until the time of Charlemagne looked like this. And there's another, they didn't have any spaces between the words. Another factor in this development that I'm talking about is what writing looked like before Charlemagne. Not only were there no spaces between words, but this is a typical text from the 8th century before the reforms of Charlemagne and his scholars in Aachen. Now, can you read that, Bridget?
No.
That's pretty much gobbledygook. And if you're if you have some time later, I've given a transcription of what the first line says. If you are masochistic and you would like to just see whether you can figure out any of this text, what Charlemagne's scholars did was to introduce, and this is also, by the way, I don't know whether I mentioned it, but that ancient manuscript that was the Gospel of Matthew, and this is also a manuscript that was the Gospel of Matthew, and I'm showing you the first couple of pages. What Charlemagne and his scholars did was to introduce a new form of writing. Scholars today call this form of writing Carolingian minuscule. And this form of writing, well, Bridget, read this to me, right where the pointer is.
Jacob?
Autem, very good.
Genuit.
Well, it's an I, but we would put a J there. Joseph. Virum, that's an abbreviation. Virum.
Maria.
You can, if you knew Latin, you would know it's, well, maybe even if you don't know Latin, you can sort of figure out what it's saying. But the main point is that Charlemagne's scholars invented this new form of writing. That's good. You can go back. They invented this new form of writing, and all the texts that were written after roughly 800 AD, they're all written in this Carolingian minuscule. And what that meant was that all of the older manuscripts were tossed away. We have very few manuscripts from before roughly 800 AD. Or to put it another way, to show you the importance of this shift, this cultural shift. First of all, word separation, which was extraordinarily important for legibility. And secondly, this new form of writing, which one thing I should mention is that these letter forms are very similar to the letter forms we have in print today, aren't they? Because our letter forms today directly date back to Carolingian minuscule, and these letter forms that these scholars invented around 800 AD at Charlemagne's palace school. But the main point that I would like to make, or main piece of evidence I'd like to shove under your noses to prove how important this change was, is that 90% of all the texts that we have, literary, historical, philosophical, theological, legal, 90% of all the texts that we have of works that date before roughly 700 AD are written in Carolingian minuscule. What that means is that the preservation of the literature of the Latin ancient world is almost entirely preserved in 8th and 9th century manuscripts that are written in this new script. And the last point that I would make about this is that when Renaissance scholars in the age of printing developed typefaces for their new printing presses, they went back to these Carolingian manuscripts and they copied the fonts, the typefaces, from these Carolingian Renaissance, from these Carolingian minuscule manuscripts, and they used them for their printing presses because they thought, the Renaissance scholars thought, that a manuscript like this dated back to ancient Rome. They could not believe that these were produced in the 9th century. They thought for sure that these must be original Roman manuscripts. And with that wonderful thought, I'll see you next week on Monday. And remember that there is a quiz.
Does the quiz go talk about Charlemagne?
It might.
Also class or just the quiz?
Oh yes, the quiz is always the last 20 minutes of the class, like the first one that you experienced.
Okay.
So you, if you wish, you can still come to class.
I'll be here.
Okay.
And by the way, the music was Madame Butterfly. From the opera?
No.
I know what opera is. I always mix the two.
Think about it some more.
Yeah. It's Italian?
It's Italian, that's right.
Puccini?
Puccini, that's right.
I know.
Good job today, Bridget.
I was hoping we were going to talk about Songs of Roland.
Pardon? Pardon?
I was hoping you were going to talk about Solomon. I love Solomon.
I'm going to talk about... I did talk about, very briefly, the Song of Rome. Yeah. No, no, last time, if you remember. I just mentioned it. I mentioned that Charlemagne had taken an army into Spain.
It was based
defeated.
Off of a Basque attack, right?
It wasn't. That's
but
right.
But in the actual Song of Roland, it's not Charlemagne. It's a Moor attack on I forget the name. Is it Charlemagne in the actual Song of Roland?
Yeah. He's in there. But he's away from the field of battle. It's Roland and Archbishop Turpin.
That's right.
And I'm going to talk about it in the context of the First Crusade because the Song of Roland gets written down for the first time at the end of the 11th century, which is exactly the time of the First Crusade. And the transformation of the attacking force from being Basques to Moors fits in perfectly with what's going on. They're calling crusades. You don't want the Christian Basques attacking Charlemagne's rear guard. What you want are the dirty Moors.
How they depict them is so like the enemy.
That's
savages.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
So I am going to talk about Charlemagne. And
we're going to do investiture controversy too, right? Like where
right.
Gregory and Henry are good. That's like my favorite thing.
Is it? Well, if you've had a course in which you've discussed it in detail, we're going to do a very superficial.
I know.
Have you had a course with Professor Blumenthal?
No, but I took Dr. Pecknold.
Oh.
And he did a lot of that. And then last semester I had Alvarez. So she's medieval studies. So she did a lot of these topics as well in great detail. Like we did Clairvaux's letters for the investiture contribution.
Well, this is a survey, Bridget.
Yeah.
This is going
it's
to be
a very helpful class to piece everything together. Yeah, that's what it's great. But sometimes I see things and I'm like, I just want to talk about them.
Yeah, no, it can be frustrating.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything we have to talk about?
Oh, is that the sign issue?
Yes. Didn't it get down to you?
No.
I have to apologize. I was listening to the Carolingian stuff.
Oh, and you got so excited you forgot about that. What an excuse. Am I supposed to believe that?
I was, though. I was thinking that.
Anyway.
Tacoma.
Pardon?
Puccini?
Puccini? It's Puccini, that's right.
Omeo, Bambino, Carr.
Have a good day.
You got it. So what do we do?
Just email
it? Omeo Bambino Caro.
Omeo Bambino Caro.
Yeah.
Now, how are you, how did you find that out?
Skills. No, I heard the song before.
It's a very famous aria, but how did you figure it out? I'm interested in knowing that.
It's kind of embarrassing, but I remember it on a commercial for like a video game. I just went for the soundtrack and that was it.
It
has pictures. That's right.
I used to be an orchestra too, so I mean...
Well, like, send me an email, you'll get extra credit.
Okay. Awesome.
Now, if you can figure out the singer, the diva... There are a lot of divas who sang this, by the way, in my recording. You would really have to... it would be very difficult to figure that out, I'm afraid.
To figure out what?
Oh, who the singer was.
Oh, it would be very easy, actually.
Oh, really?
Because you would just go to iTunes, and they would have like the most popular versions of the song, and they would tell you who sings it.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And then you just...
But there are probably 20 divas who sang that. Go to iTunes, see how many people have sung that. How many people are on iTunes or...
But if you're saying she's a famous up-and-coming Russian, she would be very high in popularity.
Could be.
That's how I do things.
No. I'm not gainsaying you, Samuel. I'm just saying that it would still
her
be.
Version is the more popular one, right?
Would be. Might be. With someone like me who particularly admires her. Curious whether they come up with it.
profound songs that I've heard just like once, snippet. Uh-huh. You go to iTunes and I'm able to find them just by kind of...
Really? Wow, you've got a better ear than I have. I could never do that.
Then there are apps on the iPhone now that if you're listening to something, like, uh-huh, you can actually get the information.
I had it on my cell phone. It's called Shazam.
The what?
It's called Shazam. The iPhone app.
Uh-huh.
And if you put it next to a song that's playing, it tells you everything about it. Like, you can even download it.
Wow.
Yeah, Verizon has a VCast. That's what they call it, Song ID.
Now that's something I'm completely ignorant about.
And then you can download it on the spot.
Yeah.
So you can buy it right away.
I like this song.
Boom, it's mine.
Wow. Wow, that's technology. I love the technology.
It's searching for it on iTunes right now.
No, they may not.
It's very slow here. I don't know why.
Well, it's slow.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I've got to get going.
We'll email it to you.
Whoops, I haven't divested myself of everything, however.